So today, as we go back to looking at our text, and I'm glad to get back to the text, I really enjoyed the videos, and I hope you did as well. I think they're very helpful for a perspective to fit our text within and to visualize what's going on. At the same time, it's the text that leads us into the real truth, and that becomes, those videos provide us with a framework as well as a testimony about who God is and the fact that these things really did happen. We can know they happened, and we can know things about their happening. A lot of that is based on text. The last videos we watched, the text was used significantly to determine the geographical locations of where they were and what was going on. And so today, though, it's a joy to go back to the text. We're going to be looking at Exodus 12, beginning in verse 21. Excuse me. In trying to set the context, let's go back and remind ourselves of where we were when we stopped with the text for a bit and went over into these videos. If you go clear back to chapter 10, we see at the end of that time a heated meeting between Pharaoh and Moses and Aaron. And it came as a result of the 9 plagues that occurred and Pharaoh's consistent acquiescence to let the people go, only to have a hardened heart through God's efforts and his own that would cause him to not keep the word that he gave to Moses and the descendants of Jacob. And they had locusts and they had darkness. And at the end of their meeting following the darkness, Pharaoh kicks Moses and Aaron out of his presence as he, out of his hard heart, he backs up and doesn't do what he said he was going to do. And he even gives a death threat to Moses. And Moses responds with, "You will never see my face again." And that moved us over into Exodus 11. And Moses announces to the people at God's direction this last plague that is to come. And instructions are given about how they're going to do the Passover. But at the beginning of this, one of the instructions is, ask your neighbors for gold and silver, that God would give them favor in the sight of their neighbors. And that at midnight, he's going out, and the firstborn will die of man and beast, and there will be this tremendous cry of anguish that like nothing that's ever been heard in Egypt before, except in the land of Israel. When in the land of Israel, we won't even hear a dog bark. And so those instructions are given to the people, and they're going to be reinforced time and again as we go through our lesson today. In the first 13 verses of chapter 12, we get instructions for the selection of the Passover lamb, how the meal's to be prepared, and how the blood's to be put on the doorposts. And then in verses 15 through 20, we see the Feast of the Unleavened Bread brought into the discussion. And this feast is to be established for all generations. It's to be a memorial to this day that God brings them out of Egypt. And this unleavened bread has a couple of meanings behind it. The one that is near to them right then is the haste that is required. You've got to do this quickly. There isn't time to wait for the bread to leaven. And this isn't adding yeast to bread like people do today to make bread rise, you know, a couple hours after they mix the dough up. This is the mixture that's made that it continues to grow the yeast and takes time to leaven, and then you continue to pass that on through your upcoming bread making and keep that moving forward. But there's a growth time involved. The other thing that's in the back of it that becomes more clear even in the New Testament application of what leavening means is the purity. That, you know, they're to clean the house. There's a There's a house purification from leaven that needs to be done. And clearly in the background of this is a purification from getting rid of all the sin, putting outside of their lives all those things that distract them from God. And so all these things have been going on in preparation for the actual time of the Passover, which is going to take us to Exodus 12, and we're going to begin and read the verses 21 through 28. And so let me read those for you. Then Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said to them, "Go and take for yourselves lambs according to your families, and slay the Passover lamb. You shall take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood which is in the basin, and apply some of the blood that is in the basin to the lintel and to the two doorposts, and none of you shall go outside of his house until morning. For the Lord will pass through to smite the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to smite you. And you shall observe this event as an ordinance for you and your children forever. When you enter the land which the Lord will give you, as he has promised, you shall observe this rite. And when your children say to you, 'What does this rite mean to you?' you shall say, 'It is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, who passed over the houses of the sons of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but spared our homes.'" And the people bowed and they worshiped. So here is Moses. He's called the elders together, the leaders of the various tribes, and has told these people, it's time to take the lamb. Select the lamb as directed. And it's time to slay it as instructed. And in the course of doing, they're going to collect some of the blood. And they want to put that blood on the doorposts. And that's his instructions. And he adds to that, don't go outside. So now it's beginning. It's time. They're going to begin the process of eating the meal. Now there's more that he's going to do. So they haven't left yet to go do that. But that's where we're at. This is when they go to do that. And so they're going to go do these things as Moses has directed. And he makes it clear again in verse 23 that God will pass over their homes, but the real purpose is for him to go and to smite the Egyptians. And the blood is necessary. Because he sees the blood, he's going to go by your home where that blood is that you put on the doorposts, and that's going to be your protection from the death that he is bringing to the Egyptians. Now, why is he bringing this death to the Egyptians? Is this an arbitrary moment on God's part? Just like, hey, I think I'll kill somebody? He's been systematically dismantling the gods of the Egyptians. And there's another piece to that. And that is, God is bringing punishment onto the Egyptians for their enslavement of the Israelites and their unwillingness. Yes, their hearts were hardened, but they had those hard hearts themselves. And they were not willing to let this labor force get away from them. And so that's a piece of what he's doing here, is it's punishment for the sins of the Egyptians in oppressing the descendants of Jacob, who are God's people. So it's time to do it. And things are set in motion. And Moses says, oh yeah, and by the way, don't go outside your door tonight. This is a time for you to stay inside. Why would that be important?
Could identify the Egyptians.
Who are you if you're outside the house? And the protection comes for the house, right? So that's an important piece.
I think it's interesting to consider that this is faith and obedience too. So it's the faith. faith to put the blood on the lintel of the house, but it's also obedience. You're not supposed to violate the commandment of God, otherwise you're going to feel his wrath.
Yeah, there's. I think that those are both parts of it. And I think one of the things that we can just recognize even from a just being in the moment standpoint with them, can you imagine the, I don't know if fear is the right word, but the awe and the curiosity when you start hearing the cry come out of the Egyptians over this death? That's going to be, for some, maybe a moment of victory. Ha! You know, we're finally going to get our freedom. And for others, hearing that might be a real moment of just, wow, this is an awesome moment. This is really something. And yet, this is a time to be acting out of your faith toward God, not a time to be out being a curious human and to be out as a part of what's going on there in that way. And you brought up something I wanted to ask about. So, what do you think about the faith it took to put the blood on the doorpost? Did that take... Talk about how you visualize what faith meant in those moments.
Well, to this point, they've seen the gods, God as representing those as the one true God through all of the plagues that he's put on the Egyptians. So it had to build their faith in him to that extent. So certainly when he commanded them to do something,
and God has differentiated in previous times between what happened to the Egyptians and what happened to the Israelites. Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty significant event that's going to occur, and it's a very simple thing to put this blood on their doorposts. And if you think about the context of these plagues, I'm not trying to take anything away from their faith in doing it, but if the God of these plagues said, do this or I'm going to kill your firstborn, you're going to do it. If you have any trust in what God's doing at all. And so these people have a lot of faith lessons yet to learn, don't they? Matter of fact, a lot of those lessons as we cross the land and work our way toward the promised land of Canaan, they're going to flunk a lot of those faith lessons, aren't they? They're going to show who they, what's really in their heart. And yet at this moment, it's pretty straightforward and pretty obvious that this is the God that's brought these plagues. We've lived through them. This is the final one, according to Moses, and this is what's going to happen. And it would certainly be almost illogical to not put the blood on their doorposts. And so as they continue to look at that, in verse 25, God goes on to say through Moses that this is going to be a rite for you when you enter the promised land. So it's being made clear that this isn't just for this one moment. This isn't just for this one plague. You are going to make this a part of your living out what it means to be one of Abraham's offspring, what it means to be one of the ones that either were rescued out of Egypt or descendants of those. This is going to continue, and it continues for a purpose. What is the purpose? What example does Moses give for how they will use this rite? Look there in verse 31. What do you see? I'm sorry, verse 25. What do you see?
It's to be a reminder.
It's to be a reminder.
One of those things that says, don't ever forget what God has done here.
Yeah, and in verse 26 is where I should have directed you. And he says, and when your children ask. You know, this is a mechanism by which the events and the testimony about what God did during this moment of Passover will be handed down through the generations. When the children ask, Why are we doing this? Why do you do it? What does it mean to you? It's your time to say, this is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord who passed over the houses of the sons of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians but spared our homes. And when you look at that, what is the sacrifice here? When they say this is the sacrifice, what is the sacrifice? This isn't a hard question.
The killing of the lamb.
Yeah, the lamb. Here's the lamb that they're going to take this lamb's life and they're going to consume the lamb and they're going to take its blood to put the markings on the doorpost as prescribed by God through Moses to protect them. And so now they get to tell of the events again that actually happened. And I imagine the first few generations, well, if the Israelites had done better in their first few generations, this would have been a real fun story. But as it was, and they have some of their troubles with their faith getting to the promised land, there's more to come. But imagine what it would be like to be talking to your uncle or your grandfather or whomever that, oh, you were there when this happened. What was that like? Imagine what a testimony should have been started right here, and probably was. I mean, the Passover is still celebrated today. And it would be quite a testimony to talk to the people that were there and experience that, despite some of the failings that are going to come out of this generation as they cross over into the promised land. And so this is God establishing this as a part of baseline what it means to be a Jew, baseline on understanding their position in God's kingdom based on the actions of God. This is a huge event that they're talking about, and at least to much of the extent they get it, because in verse 27, and when they heard this, they bowed down and they worshiped. And that was the right response, wasn't it?
Yes.
As we look at those events in our lives, with the linchpin event being a sacrificial lamb whose blood was shed to be applied to us, that we may be figuratively washed white as snow through the blood of Christ. I mean, that should be our response, shouldn't it? What an opportunity to worship when you recognize just what it is that Christ has done. And we see that over and over as Paul writes, when he gets to the work of Christ, he just breaks out in worshipful words to praise God and to recognize what was done. And so in like manner, that's where we should be. And also in all of this, we see clearly, don't we, what we might call a type of Christ or the forerunning of Christ, the example and the relation to it. What's similar here to what we see in Christ?
The sacrifice.
Instead of a lamb, the sacrifice is Christ. What else do we see?
Firstborn.
Jesus was a firstborn. And he gave his life. Okay, what else?
Redemption through the blood.
Redemption through the blood. Without the shedding of the blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. What else? Okay. Yeah, the lamb didn't cause this whole mess, did he? Yes, sir.
Christ commands us to remember, you know, to do our communion in remembrance of him.
We too have a right to remember the physical as well as spiritual sacrifice of Christ. By spiritual, I mean that he suffered the wrath of God in our place. Okay, what else? So, in this account, who is under condemnation in Egypt? the Egyptians. If we wanted to say it in a very simple physical way, everyone without the blood. And if a Jew, and I'm not saying any Jew did this, but if one of the descendants of Jacob had decided to not put the blood up, would they have suffered the condemnation? I think it's very clear that that was what Moses said. We're only going to be passing over, God is only going to be passing over the houses that have the blood on the doorposts and on the lintel. And isn't that the way the world is? Who stands condemned now? In the world we live in, post-Christ, post the cross. Everyone without the blood. We start condemned, but when the blood is put up, the blood of Christ in our case, we could go over and read in Hebrews, where he took his own sacrificial blood into the Holy of Holies as the sacrifice to pay for sins. His sacrifice was adequate. The first and only sacrifice in all of history that was adequate. This was an inadequate sacrifice. These people were still going to have to deal with their sin. They were still going to stand condemned at times. They still were not saved by the blood of Christ in calendar time. And so they were going to have to continue sacrifices throughout their history until they look upon Christ as the sacrifice for their sins. And so there are many things here that show the type of Christ, and there are others that we're probably not thinking of as we work through this for these few moments here. So he establishes a rite that they will remember. It clearly shows much of what would be coming in. This is symbolic for what would be coming in reality through Jesus Christ. Any other questions or comments through those verses? Okay, well, let's start in with verse 29 and read through 32. Now it came about at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on the throne in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of cattle. Pharaoh arose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was no home where there was not someone dead. Then he called for Moses and Aaron at night and said, "Rise up, get out from among my people, both you and the sons of Israel, and go worship the Lord as you have said. Take both your flocks and your herds as you have said, and go and bless me also." So this is the event. And as much as possible, we ought to try to put ourselves in that moment and just see what God has done. About midnight in verse 29, it says, he struck all the firstborn of Egypt, both from the standpoint of Pharaoh and all the people, as well as the cattle and the livestock and so on. And so there wasn't a house that didn't have death in it. Now, did Pharaoh know this was coming?
He was told.
Well, he wasn't really. This is the one plague that was not clearly told to Pharaoh ahead of time. It wasn't "let my people go" or. This is one that after Moses left on the heated argument, if we go back over to 11 and 12, we'll see that Moses, his announcement is to the people and not to Pharaoh about what's to come. So here is Pharaoh, and this cry goes over Egypt. And so here is sudden, unexpected death everywhere that they would turn, in their homes, in the feedlot, in the pastures. Anywhere you looked, there was death. And it wasn't just death of some people, it was death of the firstborn, the one that was prominent in certain ways. I mean, even in our own homes, that firstborn child takes on a little bit of a special place for a while, because this is the first child, and all of those expectations and the beginning of parenting and all the things that go along with it. And in these eras, it was even more significant, in that in most cultures, the firstborn was going to be the new head of the family at some day. And so they were giving extra things to prepare them for that. Hopes and dreams were placed on them. And so here is all the firstborn dead in Egypt. What do you suppose got Pharaoh up? Well, we don't know, but there are certain possibilities. A servant in his own house waking him up, your son is dead. The cry, can you imagine not hearing the cry in the land? The wailing. Yes, that's right. That can be very much a part of it. And so here is this night of death and anguish. How do you suppose the people of the land responded? We'll get a chance to look at that in a little bit. When you're a leader of people and things don't go well for the people, what happens?
Revolting.
There's a certain amount of, what are you going to do about this? How did this happen? What's going on here? I need answers. How are we going to stop whatever bad thing is going on? So, Pharaoh grows up in verse 30. In verse 31, what does he do? Who does he call for?
Aaron and Moses.
Why would he call for Aaron and Moses?
So
God's representative, he knows. He knows. He knows what happened, to an extent at least. He knows this is not some plague, or, well, it's a plague, but it's not some disease that just went through and overnight killed only the firstborn. You know, it's obvious. And he gets it. And he sees the death, and he sees all that's going on. So he calls for Aaron and Moses, and because he sees, he knows this is from God. What does he tell Aaron and Moses to do?
Get out of here. Get all your stuff and leave town.
You and your people and your things are to go. And it's interesting. He says, go and worship as you've requested. Take your flocks and your herds. Remember, that was one thing that kind of was a sticky point. He wanted to keep the flocks and the herds so they would come back. And then he says, go and bless me also. Do you think Pharaoh repented here?
No.
Yeah, nobody I read in searching things out saw this as any kind of genuine repentance. But probably an admission of defeat. Okay, you and your God have beaten us. So go out and worship and ask for blessing for us too. It was a way of saying, I give up, you win, go. MacArthur in his study Bible, if your folks look at that, called it clearly a temporary conceit, temporary conceding defeat and acknowledgement of Moses and God as victors. So, throughout the time of these plagues, throughout the time when Moses came back to Egypt at God's direction, which, don't forget, he didn't really do that very willingly, did he? But what's the message to Pharaoh constantly? Let my people go. And Pharaoh says, sometimes yes, but it always turns out to really be no. What does Pharaoh now say to God?
Bless me.
Well, bless me, but what about the people? Go. Leave my people. All of a sudden, Pharaoh's thinking about his people. For a long time, he viewed these Israelites as a possession, as a free workforce, as people that would come and just serve him at his profit. And now he sees that, no, our keeping of these Israelites as slaves is jeopardizing our own survival and the survival of the people who are truly my people. And so now he says, you leave my people. Doesn't talk about, I'm letting your people go. He's saying, get away from us. And that is really what he wants. Questions? Thoughts?
I have a question. I don't understand why the firstborn of the animals. That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I know who has the answer to that, and it's not me. You know, clearly it's the purpose of God here. I mean, he's just being thorough. And in a lot of these plagues, the destruction was inclusive against the animals. When he brought the hail, if you got an animal that's outside, it's going to die. I mean, so a lot of his destruction was on the animals. Now, a thing I would say that I have some degree of confidence in, most of Pharaoh's gods were animal-related. I would have a tough time pulling them out of my mind, but I remember the god with the name of Hecht had a cow's face. And you could continue on down through most of the plagues, these animals, they worship frogs. They love frogs. Well, instead of getting to worship them, they're plagued by them. And you can keep going with that throughout the various plagues. And so did the firstborn cover it for that reason? I would not pretend to have the mind of God, but I can certainly see the connection that might be made here between all of these animals that they worshiped and God saying, watch this, poof, no more firstborn of these animals.
I kind of thought too, so if you look at the Abrahamic covenant, part of that covenant is that God will bless those who bless the nation of Israel and curse those who curse the nation of Israel. And I think that those blessings and curses aren't just individual in nature. They're national in nature. So if we look at the sphere of sovereignty that exists with the Egyptian Empire, God's hand of wrath isn't just against the people of Egypt. God's hand of wrath is against the entire nation of Egypt. And so if you look at the nations, those encompass not only the people, but also the goods and services and buildings and things like that that exist in a particular place. And so I think that what we can see here isn't necessarily that God's retribution is, you know, he's taking out wrath for sin on animals who can't sin. That's not the case. But what he is doing is he's exercising his wrath against a nation who hasn't heeded the Abrahamic covenant, the Abrahamic promises of blessing the nation of Israel.
That's a good point. You said it well. A word I might put in there, he also attacked or brought damage to those things that they thought they had dominion over. And they had dominion over their livestock and herds, and God just thinned them out. So, good comments. Good question. Good comments. Anything else? Okay, well, let's take a look at verses 33 through 41. Turn the page. The Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, we will all be dead. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, and with their kneading bowls bound up in the clothes on their shoulders. And now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing, and the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they let them have their request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. Now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from the children. A mixed multitude also went up with them, along with the flocks and the herds and a very large number of livestock. They baked the dough which they had brought out of Egypt into cakes of unleavened bread, for it had not become leavened since they were driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. Now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. And at the end of 430 years to the very day, all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. All right. So now we're looking at the Egyptian people and the descendants of Jacob as they leave. What was the message from the Egyptians to the Israelites?
Take everything I got and go.
Hurry up, get out of here. They want separation, and they want it as soon as they can get it. And so they have an internal motivation. What were they saying to themselves?
We're all going to die.
We're all going to die. There's some of us left alive. Get out of here and let's stop this chaos of plagues and death. They have lived through multiple plagues, and now we have this final one with all of this death. And so they are now fully convinced that if they don't get the Israelite people out of there, they will not survive. They have recognized there's a God here at work, because Moses was esteemed among the people. They recognized him as a representative of the God Most High, the God that the Israelites were worshiping, and they recognized this God's going to kill us all if we don't do what Moses is asking us to. So it was go. And so what did the people of Israel take from their own possessions? They make a list there.
The unleavened dough.
They didn't have time for it to leaven up. What else? Mixing bowls, kneading bowls.
Livestock.
They took the livestock.
Silver and gold.
Well, they took silver and gold, but from amongst their own possessions, clothes. And it says they bound them up on their back. I have this image, don't know if it's completely accurate, but I have this image of all of these people with essentially not backpacks like college kids take to school or high school kids or grade school kids, but like mountaineers in their backpacks. Here they've got this stuff bound up on their backs, and they're all ready to march off. And at the same time, they've given this request for gold and silver and clothes. And what do the Egyptians give them? Whatever they want. You know, it's kind of like that old joke, that, you know, what's a 600-pound gorilla eat for dinner? Whatever he wants. Well, same story here, but not in humor. In reality, the people of Egypt want the people that are descendants of Jacob out of there. And you want gold and silver to go? Take it. I'm sure you could say with a fair degree of accuracy that if they believe that they're not going to survive if these people don't go, what do I need to keep my gold and silver for if these people are going to hang around and wait on it? Give it to them. Get them out of here. They are done with them. And so, in verse 34, the Israelites took their stuff, including large flocks. Because remember, what was their... This goes back to our study in Genesis. When Jacob and family arrived, what was their chief line of work?
They were shepherds.
When they were presented to Pharaoh, what did Pharaoh say to Joseph and to Jacob about that line of work and how they might fit in? Maybe you can shepherd my flocks. Why did they look for others to do their shepherding?
They thought it was a very poor profession.
They did not have much respect. They were the lowlifes. They were the dirty people. And in some respect, physically, they probably had dirt on them more than the kinds of people, the kinds of things the Egyptians wanted to be doing. But so they were shepherds by trade, and they are still shepherds. They still have large flocks. And they take them out, and they take along this gold and silver. So I imagine you also see added to their list, they probably had a few donkey carts and a few things as well. The result, we're told in verse 36, is they plundered Egypt. Now, what was the status of Egypt in the world? They were a superpower. They were number one. They were the rich people. They were the ones with all the stuff. As a matter of fact, during Joseph, they really were the ones with all the stuff, right? Because they had all the food. And people traded everything they owned, ultimately, for the food. And Joseph set it up. Before he was done, Pharaoh owned all the land. And he had a sharecropping system that was pretty fair. But nonetheless, Pharaoh owned everything. And so now 430 years have gone by. We know that from what's coming up in another verse. And they are now taking the Egyptian wealth with them as they go. In verse 36, it says, God gave them favor with the Egyptians. Does that mean the Egyptians liked them?
No.
What did it mean they had favor?
He said yes.
Yeah, whatever you want. They were going to be heeded. Their requests were going to be met, if at all possible, to get them going. By the way, how many went? Huh? How many men left?
600,000
men. And that's where we get to adding families and so on. And it probably was 1.5 to 2 million. And what is wild to me, but I get it. I know, because when you see it, you get to understand the thought processes behind it. But there are a lot of scholars, men who are Jewish by bloodlines, men who are Jewish by religion, men who are Christians, men who want to even say they really believe God and His Word, try to get this down to about 20,000 total people. And they do it through all kinds of human logic. And at the same time, I think we can look at this and get a pretty accurate number. How many people left? Well, I don't know how many total, but we got 600,000 men. We're not going to carve that down to 20 somehow. So 600,000 men left. Verse 38 says something interesting that we ought not to miss. Verse 38 says, a mixed multitude also went up with them, along with flocks and herds and a very large number of livestock. What's this mixed multitude?
Other Egyptians.
Egyptians, maybe other people who were or immigrants to Egypt that decided they were going with the Israelites. So other nations, some Egyptians, maybe many Egyptians. Do you suppose some of these were genuine God followers?
No.
Maybe a few. But by and large, why are these people going with the Israelites?
They want to go with the winners.
Using a phrase a friend of mine said one time, it's not hard to quit being a Raiders fan. There's so many other winning teams out there at the time. This was a Wolf Creek thing. We had a lot of Raiders fans there. They came from that part of the country. But, yeah, if I have to choose, I'd just as soon go with the folks that are still alive. I'd just as soon go with the folks that aren't getting plagues brought on them. I'd just as soon go with the folks that are doing the plundering. And so a big part of this was that they were going with the flow, going with the winning team. Go over to Numbers 11, 4 through 6. These verses from Numbers 11 go along with part of what's going on during their trek. And so this is a good place to go look at this, because we get another picture at these same people, or at least a portion of them. Numbers 11, 4 through 6. The rabble who were among them had greedy desires. Now this is the Israelite group. And also the sons of Israel wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which were used to eat free in which we used to eat free in Egypt, and the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our appetite is gone. There is nothing at all to look at except this manna. Who was it that brought that up?
Rabble.
That is the same word used back here in Exodus for the mixed multitudes. And so is it man by man the same? No, but one of the things that happened as these people went along with the Israelites is some of these people, this mixed multitude, looked back and said, I liked eating out in Egypt a whole lot more than I like eating manna off the ground out here in the desert. What was their problem? Their problem was they liked well-spiced food more than they liked the God that saved them out of the land of death. whether you're talking about some Israelites that were greedy and joined in with them, or whether you're talking about people that went with them who weren't really truly with them. And we can look at that and go, what foolish people. Well, you better go home and look in the mirror a little bit too. We like a lot of things, don't we? There's a lot of things that when you start shaking our pot that we live in and say, oh, these things might go away, we get pretty riled up pretty fast. The main thing for us as believers is not the condition of the world we live in. Do I need to say that again? You can be a believer. There are believers around the world living in lots of conditions very worse, different than ours. And yet, we'll get fighting mad over some of the smallest inconveniences. Yes, I just called something like a tax increase a small inconvenience. It's not as big a deal as we think it is. The big deal is, are we following our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ and His Father that sent Him through the power of the Holy Spirit that leads us into all truth? Are we following Him out of faith to live as a testimony to our trust in Him and our joy in serving Him, regardless of what the physical circumstances are? We could go read Paul. He says, I've learned to rejoice in little and in much. I'm fine if I have nothing. I'm fine if I have a lot. That doesn't matter. What matters is, who is Jesus Christ in my life, and how does that fit in to living in this life as a brother to Christ and as an adopted child of God the Father? And so here are these people that get mixed in that later on are a part of, at least, a problem with the grumbling of the Israelites as they're out in the promised land being led and fed by God to that promised land. Questions, comments?
You said that the word rabble and mixed.
Mixed multitudes.
It's the same word as that, like in Hebrew?
Yes, in Hebrew. I'm sorry. I didn't make more notes than that. At least it's of the same general root. And so here are these people out there causing problems. If we look on to verse 39, it says there that they, when they got there, they made themselves a meal, and they're still eating unleavened bread because what they took wasn't leavened and it hadn't been time yet for it to become leavened. And then, so they left in a hurry, is what that saying is. And then in verse 40 and 41, it said they had been in Egypt 430 years to the very day. Go over to Galatians 3, 16 through 18. This is Paul with a slightly, very slightly different context, but basically the same. Galatians 3, 16 through 18. Can't make my fingers find Galatians. Here we go, Galatians 3, 16 through 18. And this is Paul talking about the law being a curse and some other things. But in verse 16 he says, now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. He does not say, and to seeds, as referring to many, but rather to one. And to your seed, that is, he's talking about Christ. What am I saying? What I am saying is this. The law, which came 430 years later, does not invalidate a covenant previously ratified by God so as to nullify the promise. And so we get into an interesting discussion here amongst people that want to figure things out based on logic. And that is, how long were the Israelites in Egypt? And it seems rather straightforward to me with what's said in the book of Exodus in verse 40 and 41 is it was 430 years to the day. Can we argue with that? I mean, if he said about 430 years, we might start having discussion. Well, what was it really? But when it says 430 years to the day that they were in Egypt, and we have to look at this just a little bit more. We've got to find it here. Verse 40 and 41. Here we go. At the end of 430 years to the very day, the host of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. And it talks about the sons of Israel lived in Egypt 430 years. So do the sons of Israel, sons of Jacob, does that include Abraham?
Yes.
No.
No.
Abraham was Jacob's grandfather. Yeah. So we're never going to call Abraham a son of Jacob. We can say he was the beginning of the Jewish nation. And so in that sense, you could say he was Jewish, or maybe you couldn't really even say Israelite if you want to think about language, because the name Israel started with Jacob. So it says to me here, the offspring of Jacob were there 430 years. The interesting thing, people use the Galatians passage as a way to open the door to start arguing about it, because Paul says, well, it started with the covenant. When would the covenant come? Well, Abraham. But I want to take you to Genesis 15, 13. Genesis 15, 13. And in Genesis 15, 13, God said, oh, that's a different one than the one I was looking for, but that's okay, we'll get to it. God said to Abraham, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. But I will judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. By the way, are we reading what just was promised here to Abraham? I'm going to judge them. Were they judged? Oh boy. Did they come out with many possessions?
Yeah.
Absolutely. So some people say, well, the 430 years, I'm kind of skipping around, forgive me for that. 430 years, I'm going to do this a little bit differently. I want to take you to this other passage. Did I not write that passage down? Surely I did. It's where?
I think it's verse 15, in Genesis.
Chapter 15, verse 15?
Verse 15 of the chapter we read.
Well, let me get
and
back there.
You shall go to your father's institute.
I'm looking for where Jacob is given peace about moving to Egypt. God talks to Jacob when he spends the night. Sorry, I'm going to take the moment it takes to find that because we need to see it. I'm looking at it in the wrong place because I didn't. Okay, Jacob moves to Egypt. Okay, here we are. Chapter 46 of Genesis. Sorry for the delay. So Jacob, Israel, in verse 1, set out with all that he had, and he came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. Now they're already leaving at Joseph's request to go to Egypt. In verse 2, God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. And he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes. Now, this isn't exactly the covenant wording as Abraham received it. But this is the last time in the book of Genesis. God has repeated this covenant multiple times. He repeated it to Abraham more than once. He also brought it to Isaac, and here he's brought it to Jacob again. This is the last time, and it's while they're on their way to Egypt. And so I believe this marks the covenant that starts the 430-year clock. This is the last time that it is mentioned. So why am I taking you through this a little bit? Because you can read people, some who are very reputable. I'll even name one, Answers in Genesis. I was looking to find some clarity to bring to you very easily reinforcement of this 430 years despite other things I was reading. And Answers in Genesis would say, no, it starts with Abraham. And so how were Abraham's offspring brought into harmful behavior by Egypt when they didn't even live in Egypt? Well, they go to Ishmael's mother was an Egyptian, and so when Ishmael picked on Isaac, that was the beginning of the oppression of the offspring. I can't get there from here. And so I started out just kind of taking you through my path a little bit, going, boy, there's all these different things, and they all have some validity to at least an argument that has something you can see that makes some sense. So how does it all work out? And the more I read, the more confused I got. And after some time of prayer and a little bit of consideration, it says, hold on, Rick, you're doing this backwards. Let's start with what's written in Exodus. 430 years to the day. I can't explain some of the other things other people say. Part of it is there are some in the beginning of Exodus, there's a little bit given in an early chapter, I'll just say it that way, about some of the genealogies. And they go, well, there's only three generations. You can't get from 70 people to 600,000 in three generations, but there's only three listed, so 215 years. They wind up dividing this into two. It's a mess. It just creates nothing but confusion. But I can look at the scriptures and see that the offspring of Jacob were in Egypt for 433 years. And I can believe that and go on and start putting the other pieces together. If I can't fit them exactly, that just means there are some things I don't know. And so I'm confident that the right way to approach this is to look at the text and believe what it says. And I don't know how it could be more clear. Questions, comments? Okay. Well, I'm looking at the clock. Really had intended to get to the end. So we'll start with Exodus 12, verse 42 next time. And I certainly don't mind questions or comments or things you might see and want to bring up. Maybe it'll move me to a better spot than where I'm sitting now, but I really believe they were there 430 years to the day. I think that's very clear, and that to me is the mile marker around which we have to place every other thing we want to believe about that, and so on. So, you have a good day, and I will see you next week.